We're going to have some fun this week, I hope. I guess it's all right to say that. I think when you start learning about spiritual things and study the Word of God, it ought to be something that we enjoy doing. And I hope that we're going to enjoy our series this week and studying about these things. And I know I've come to appreciate this study. It's been very helpful to me, and I want to share with you some of the things that we've learned this week, or learned before, and bring them to you this week, and hope that they'll be helpful to you. I think one of the neat things, I know that my wife, it's interesting that sometimes when you're studying your Bible, sometimes people think, oh, that's a boring thing to do, and it's not much fun. But I find it very, very exciting to study the Bible, and there are often times I will learn something and have to run and talk to Candy and say, look what I learned, and I'll share it with her, and she'll go, okay, that's good, you know. But it is fun to learn things about the Bible, and hopefully we can teach you some things or talk about some things. If not teaching you new things that you didn't know, at least reminding you of things that you have known. And particularly, we're hoping that through our efforts this week, we can glorify God and bring Him praise and honor. And that's really the whole point here, is to do that and then to also be edified as well. We got a lot of ground to cover tonight, and so we're going to have to move quickly. But I don't want to move so quickly that we end up putting you into an information overload. But I do want to give you enough information that will hopefully, enough historical backdrop that will hopefully make this series of lessons meaningful to you. I'm going to share some things with you on a PowerPoint. I would probably encourage you not to try to take down all of those things. You might want to write down some of the main points or whatever, but if you are interested in getting a copy of the PowerPoints because it's just too much to write down, I'd be happy to let you have that. I'll also make copies of my sermons and make them available to you in outline form. You're welcome to have one of those. But remember, again, like we talked about this morning, that what I have written down or what I've said or what I preach, that really is not, unless it's got to be consistent with the words of the Lord. And what we're trying to do is to turn your attention to the Word of God and help you focus on that and see and understand His words. So I hope we can do that in these lessons. I'm going to throw out several dates for you tonight, and they're going to be accurate to within a year or two either way, depending on the historian that you're looking at. But I would suggest to you that the biblical backdrop for this particular events, we will also bring in some secular historical events or information that will help color or paint the picture in a little bit brighter way for us. But the historical backdrop is found in 2 Kings chapter 23 through the end of the book there, and in 2 Chronicles 35 to the end of the book. We're actually in this historical sketch going to back up just a little bit further, a few chapters earlier than that, with the things that I'll share with you tonight. But if you want to get kind of a basic idea of exactly what the circumstances were that resulted in Daniel's being taken captive and living in captivity, then I would suggest that you read these sections. I would also suggest, as Steve said, that I think it would be a great idea if you wanted to do some reading in preparation for the lessons each night, you get one of those announcements, because it tells you what the sermon is going to be that particular night, and it gives you the text that we're going to be discussing, and the better you have that information in your mind, the more you're going to maybe be enriched when we get together and talk about those things together. So let's start by talking about the historical backdrop that rests behind or that is involved in the study of the book of Daniel. I'm going to start, as I mentioned a little earlier, than 2 Kings chapter 23 and 2 Chronicles 35. I'm going to start with Hezekiah and talk to you a little bit about Hezekiah, the king of Judah, whose reign ended in about 696 B.C., Hezekiah was an extremely good king in many, many ways, and yet about halfway through his reign as a king, he became mortally ill and was actually told that his life was going to end. He needed to get his house in order, but through prayer he asked God to extend his life, and the mercy of God, through the mercy of God, his life was extended another 15 years, 15 years in which his son Manasseh, who would follow him on the throne, would be born. Also during that 15 years, Hezekiah foolishly tried to impress the king of Babylon with the treasuries that he owned there in Jerusalem. Probably he did that in an effort to ally the Babylonian king. And as a result of that, Isaiah predicted that Babylon would eventually take it from him, from his descendants, and so he was going to ultimately lose those things in his descendants. He is replaced after his death by his son Manasseh, who reigned from 696 to 642, a 55-year reign. And it was a horrible reign in many ways because Manasseh was one of the most corrupt kings of the southern kingdom of Judah. He was a grossly wicked king. He was so wicked, in fact, that God decided that he would be taken into Assyrian captivity. And so God used the Assyrians to punish Manasseh. He was taken into captivity. But interestingly enough, Manasseh, in his troubled circumstance as a prisoner in Assyria, he repented and evidently repented genuinely, so much so that God actually restored him to Judah, allowed him to come back to Judah and to sit on his throne again. And he tried to do things, he tried to make up for the things that he had done that were wrong, but in the end it was his sin and the sin of Judah that produced the final straw that brought about Israel's incurable wound, as Jeremiah describes it in Jeremiah chapter 15 and verse 18, an incurable wound which would ultimately result in the southern kingdom of Israel also going into captivity. You must remember that earlier than all of this that we've talked about, actually about 722, the northern kingdom has already been taken into Assyrian captivity, and so they're out of the picture. And so we're just dealing with the southern kingdom of Judah. Well, when Manasseh died, he was replaced on the throne by his son Amon. And even though Manasseh had tried to rectify some of his sins, when his son became king, he went back to his father's wicked ways. And he was such a wicked king that ultimately he was assassinated by some of his own people. He was then replaced by one of the great kings of Israel, a man by the name of Josiah. He reigned from about 639 to 608 B.C., and he, as I mentioned, was a fantastic king, one of the best kings. He purged Israel, or Judah, from all the sins that Amon had brought back and that had continued from the time of his father Manasseh when his father was doing wicked things. He purged Judah of all that sin and led them again to obey God. Unfortunately, as Babylon began to overtake Assyria, Pharaoh Necho, who was the king of Egypt, he decided that he would come do something that was uncharacteristic of him. He would come to the aid of his old foe, the Assyrians, in an effort to stay off the Babylonians. And during that effort to go up there and help the Assyrians, Josiah decided somehow that he would intercept Pharaoh Necho. And we don't know why he did that. It's one of the biblical mysteries of the Bible, one of the mysteries of biblical history. We don't understand why Josiah decided to do that, this good king, but in doing that, in the battle that where he went to try to intercept Pharaoh Necho, Josiah was killed. And so his son, Jehoahaz, becomes the next king of Judah, beginning in 608, because he only reigned for 3 months. After 3 months of reign, Pharaoh Necho, who now, having overthrown Josiah, has basically taken control or trying to take control of Judah. In fact, is doing that pretty successfully. And so what he does is he imprisons Jehoahaz, takes him off to Egypt where he dies in captivity, and replaced him on the throne with his brother, a man by the name of Eliakim. And he gave Eliakim a name changed his name to Jehoiakim. And we get these Kims and Chins and all that kind of sometimes becomes difficult. But this is Jehoiakim, and he becomes the king. And Pharaoh Necho, imposed a severe tax on the nation of Judah, which Jehoiakim had to get from by imposing a tax on his people. Necho wanted this tribute money, and to get that tribute money, Jehoiakim had to tax his own people heavily in order to raise that. And so he becomes the servant of Pharaoh Necho. Of course, Jehoiakim, as I mentioned, becoming king in 608, reigning to 597, initially he served Pharaoh Necho because Pharaoh Necho was the guy who actually put him on the throne. But as Nebuchadnezzar began to flex his muscle, the Babylonian king began to flex his muscle and began to make moves in the direction of Egypt, moves against Egypt, which involved his coming through Jerusalem or through Judea, and actually he besieges the city of Jerusalem. Jehoiakim wisely decides to surrender to Babylon, and he does that in the year 606 BC, which constitutes the first stage of the three stages of the Babylonian captivity. And I want you to understand that what we're going to learn is that though many times as we read these texts, it seems like these things are happening at the will of these men, we learn as we read the text closely that it's actually God who's causing these things to happen. And so it's very clear from the book of Daniel chapter 1 that the Lord is the one who gave Judah to the Babylonians. And it's during this first stage of the Babylonian captivity that Daniel and his three friends that we're going to read about in the book of Daniel, that they are taken captive. Jehoiakim continued to reign as king in Judah, the puppet king of the Babylonians, because they were basically their captives. But ultimately he rebelled against Nebuchadnezzar, which set up, and this happened just before his death, and this set up the very short reign of his son, Jehoiachin. And so in 597, at the death of his father, Jehoiachin becomes the king in Judah. He reigned again. He reigned only 3 months when the Babylonians began what is called the second stage of the Babylonian captivity in 597. During this captivity, or during this effort to take Israel captive, Jerusalem falls. Ezekiel the prophet, that's when Ezekiel the prophet is taken at this time. But it's also at this time that Jehoiachin the king is taken into captivity himself, and he lives out the rest of his life in Babylonian captivity. The Babylonians replaced him on the throne in Judah by his uncle Zedekiah, who served Babylon for 9 years until in 586 BC he likewise rebelled, and that brought in the third and final stage of the captivity, where Jerusalem was destroyed, the temple was destroyed along with it, and all the temple treasuries and that sort of thing were hauled off to Babylon. Everything got taken at that point. Now let me back up for just a minute with that historical backdrop in the terms of the nation of Judah, and let me sort of plug in the Babylonian history as well for just a moment. We're going to bring Babylon's history into view. The Babylonians, Babylonia, rose to world dominance during the reign of Nabopolassar, who reigned from 626 to about 606 BC. Nabopolassar began to raise his power, by winning four decisive victories against the Assyrians. He beat the Assyrians, first of all, at Asshur in 614 BC, then at Nineveh in 612 BC, and then at Haran in 609 BC, and finally at Carchemish in the year 606 BC. And by the time Nabopolassar had beaten the Assyrians at Carchemish, he essentially was the world dominant power. Nabopolassar's son, Nebuchadnezzar II, played a significant role in the battle of, in all of these battles, and particularly at the Battle of Carchemish. And when his father died that year, 606 BC, he became king of Babylon. In that same year, Nebuchadnezzar, when he began his reign, he began to expand his kingdom by exerting pressure toward the south on Judah. He besieged Jerusalem, and as we noted earlier, that's when Jehoiakim wisely surrendered the city of Jerusalem, or surrendered to the Babylonian king, which began this first of the three stages of the Babylonian captivity. At this time, of course, as we mentioned, that's when Daniel and his three friends are taken. So you see, sort of briefly in this sketch, the history of southern kingdom of Judah, and how the history of the Babylonian Empire fits into that, and how they intersect, so that we now have the scenario that we see when we open the book of Daniel, and we find, as we read Daniel chapter 1, in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came up to Jerusalem and besieged it, and the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the vessels of the house of God, and he brought them into the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and he brought the vessels into the treasury of his God. And so that's where the book of Daniel opens. And I hope that this sketch has not been so quick and so brief that it's confused you, but hopefully you have some sort of an idea of what's going on in the historical backdrop here that leads to the captivity. I would suggest to you that as we look and turn our attention to the book of Daniel itself now, that there are some things that I just think we ought to point out at the very beginning of this study, and that is that I have to confess that there are some very tough apocalyptic sections in the book of Daniel, particularly in chapters 7 through 12. There's some apocalyptic sections earlier in the book, but the real serious ones, the very difficult ones, start in chapter 7 and go through the end of the book. But the overriding message of the apocalyptic symbols section, the overriding message assures us that God is sovereign, that He is in control, and that His people ultimately win. His people ultimately triumph. The historical narratives that we're going to look at this week, those historical narratives show the accuracy of the central truths that are revealed in these later symbols. That God is in control of the kingdoms of men. He reigns over all, even kings. And He will deliver His people from whatever confronts them, from whatever threatens them. The book begins by reminding us that God is in control, reminding us because it tells us that Nebuchadnezzar didn't take Jerusalem, that God gave Jerusalem into the hands of Nebuchadnezzar. And His sovereignty continues to be seen throughout the first chapter especially, in that He granted Daniel favor in the eyes of the people of Babylon, and that He gave Daniel and his friends the wisdom and the intelligence and the things that they had that enabled them to excel in Babylon. God is the one who gave those things to Daniel and his friends. And so the point is that God is clearly still in control. Now, what I want you to understand as we start the book of Daniel is I want you to understand that Daniel and his friends are among some of those elite people from the nation of Judah who have been taken captive, and they are now in Babylon, and it was determined that these elite ones, some of these elite ones anyway, would be groomed for service in the Babylonian kingdom. And in order to groom them for service, they were going to be given special provisions and special training, and that's what you will maybe remember as you read the first several verses down through about verse 7 of Daniel chapter 1. One thing that I want you to remember is that as Daniel starts this situation, as we start seeing Daniel, he comes into focus and we begin to see him and his activities, one of the things that I think is important for us to recognize is that Daniel is a pretty young fella when these things happen. It's important for us to recognize that. I especially want our younger people to recognize that he was a pretty young fella. We're going to see that the book of Daniel actually spans the entire 70 years of the Babylonian captivity. Daniel is going to live throughout the entire 70 years of the Babylonian captivity and at least 3 years into the reign of Cyrus the Persian, who is the king that will overthrow the Babylonians and release Judah from its captivity. So he's going to, before the book's over, he's going to be a very old man. But if he survives 70 years, then he must have been a pretty young man, if he's at least to young manhood in the book of Daniel. He must have been a pretty young fella, maybe as young as 14, 15 years old. And I make that point because I want you to understand that if you're mature enough to understand your relationship or your responsibility to God, God holds you responsible for that. And what you need to understand as a young person is that you don't have to be an old person to serve God faithfully, that you can be a young person who is serving God faithfully, and that's very important for you to recognize. And just because you're young, we're going to find out as you study the New Testament or the Bible as a whole, it's very apparent that just because a person is young does not necessarily exempt them from responsibility. I sometimes preach a series of lessons on the book of Titus and talk about the various responsibilities that Titus was told to teach the people that he was preaching up to. He had some things to say to older men, some things to say to older women, some things to say to younger women, and some things to say to younger men. And there is one quality that occurs in every single one of those lists. That is, as he talks about the character qualities of old men, old women, young men, there's one character quality that's in all of those. And that is that a young person or that a person, God's people, are supposed to be sensible people. They're supposed to be people who exercise sound or healthy judgment. And so even though you're young, there's no excuse for not exercising sound judgment. There's no excuse for not doing what you ought to do. And we're going to see in the story of Daniel and his three friends, particularly as we go through the book of Daniel, we're going to see that especially in the beginning of the book of Daniel, Daniel is a young man. And as a young man, he is serving God faithfully. And the point is that it's possible, even in a world which is against you, even in a world where paganism and immorality is all around you, which was certainly the case for Daniel living in that pagan society of Babylon, that you can still do what you ought to do even as a young person. And so I want you to start out with that picture in your mind, that as we start the book of Daniel, Daniel is a young man. Not a young man in the sense of me being a 54-year-old young man, but a young man in the sense of someone who's maybe in the realm of 15 to 20 years old. A young person for sure. He and his buddies are this way. Well, as I mentioned, these young men are supposed to be groomed for service in Babylon, which required them learning a lot of the different things that they could be taught by the wise men of Babylon. It involved them learning language of the Chaldeans. And in order to make sure that they were cared for during this time, they were given the special provisions of special rations of food and that sort of thing to sustain them. Well, Daniel and his three friends, they don't want to be defiled by the king's food, choice wine and his choice food. And so they make a special request in Daniel chapter 1 and verse 8. Daniel made up his mind that he would not defile himself with the king's choice food and with the wine which he drank. So he sought permission from the commander of the officials that he might not defile himself. And as he talks to this official, we're told in verse 9 that God granted Daniel favor in front of this, and compassion in the sight of this commander. And even though the commander is concerned that here are these Hebrew boys that don't want to defile themselves by eating the special rations, this really good food that the king is going to give them, he's concerned that if they don't get the right kind of diet, they're not going to look very healthy. And when he brings them before the king at the prescribed time, he's going to be able to see, well, all these other guys look pretty healthy and robust. What about these four scrawny guys? What's the matter with them? And he's afraid that he's going to lose his head. The commander is afraid that he's going to lose his head in the process. And Daniel proposes a test. He says, if you will give us water and vegetables to eat for 10 days, and let us eat those provisions. And then at the end of the 10 days, you compare, you look at us, and you decide whether or not you think we are somehow lacking in nourishment and need these special provisions. So we'll let you decide at the end of 10 days. And of course, as you know, that at the end of the 10 days, Daniel and his friends look more healthy, more robust, more vigorous than the other men, the other young people who were eating this special diet that the king had provided. And so God is certainly with them. Now, the thing that I think is very important to understand about Daniel's decision and his friend's decision to not defile themselves, that this to eat the vegetables and the water instead of the king's special food, that this decision was based on a commitment that Daniel and his friends had to the God of heaven. You will notice in verse 8 that he made up his mind that he wasn't going to do that. He made a deliberate decision that he was going to do the right thing. And I would suggest to you that that deliberate decision was probably not something that just happened at that point, but that kind of commitment grew out of an upbringing in which Daniel was committed to the Lord. And what I want you to understand is that for Daniel and his three friends, serving God was a settled issue. It was a settled issue long before they faced certain other events. And we're going to come tomorrow night and talk about three men in the fire. We're going to talk about the Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and how they're thrown into the fire first. We're going to talk about that story tomorrow night. And I want you to see that these men have already committed themselves to serve the Lord. And that this matter of serving the Lord is not something that they have to sort of figure out every time they face some sort of difficulty. They evidently made up their mind that they were going to do the right thing. And folks, that is the key to serving God faithfully. And it's one of the keys, at least, to serving God faithfully. And especially when we began as a young person. We've got to have a commitment that is firmly fixed in our mind. A commitment that says, as far as I'm concerned, I don't have to weigh this issue anymore. It is a settled matter. I am going to do what the Lord wants me to do. I became a Christian on November the 19th, 1978, at the age of 20 years old. And my life was different before then. It wasn't really pretty. I'm not going to tell you anything about it too much because I'm pretty ashamed of it. But I made a decision to obey the gospel on November 19th, 1978. And I've tried my best to follow the Lord since then. I'll tell you one thing that I have never done on a Sunday morning since November 19th, 1978, is I have never laid in bed on Sunday morning wondering, am I going to get up and go to church service this morning? Am I going to go meet with the people of God? And I will tell you something, just by way of illustration, not that I think going to church services is the end all of serving God. In fact, I don't believe that at all. But I'll tell you what, there are a lot of people who struggle with that decision every Sunday morning. But the point is that when you make a commitment to God that is a settled issue, the other decisions in the future are already made. You already know what you're going to do when you're confronted with something. And that is what we see in these young men. At a young age, they made up their mind. They were going to do the right thing. They weren't going to allow themselves to be defiled by God. And if you don't learn anything else this week, that is an important lesson to learn from Daniel and his three friends. Well, as it turns out, God is with these young Israelite captives and their friends. And it turns out that they are healthier, that they are ultimately wiser, have greater insight. And even Daniel is given some special help from God. And these Israelite captives and their three friends, because they are superior in every way to all the others, they are put into the king of Babylon's personal service. They are put on his wise advisory staff. And I would suggest to you that it is, in fact, due to their place on the royal advisory staff, the place of the wise men, that their lives will soon come into jeopardy. In the second chapter of the book of Daniel, in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar had a dream. And it was a pretty much of a doozy. And it was a dream that troubled him. And his sleep left him. It woke him up and he wasn't able to go back to sleep and he couldn't sleep. And he had this insatiable desire to understand what this dream meant. What was it all about? And so the king decides, in an effort to know the meaning, he calls his Chaldean, his astrologers, his wise men, and he calls upon them to reveal the dream and interpret it. Now, these wise men are very happy to interpret the king's dream for him, if he would just let them know what the dream was. If you tell us what the dream is, we'll be glad to tell you what the dream means. Of course, Nebuchadnezzar was sharper than this. And so in order to authenticate the interpretation, he requires them to tell him the dream. He wants them to tell me what I dreamed. And if you can tell me what I dreamed, then I can be assured that your interpretation is authentic. Because nobody can tell what another man dreams. You see? So obviously, if you can tell me what I dreamed, then I can trust your interpretation of the dream. He was well aware of the fact that his wise men were not above inventing some kind of interpretation that might please him. Often that was the case of royal advisors to a large number of different kings. You know, all those kings in those days had their royal advisors, and they would ask them sometimes for help. And of course, these guys would come along and they would tell the king what they thought the king wanted to hear. They were all a bunch of yes men. And the king was aware of that. He knew that his advisors could be that way too. And so he wants to ensure that this won't happen. He says, no, you've got to tell me what the dream is, and then I can trust that your interpretation of the dream is true. Well, you can imagine the difficulty that these wise men have. They know that they don't have that kind of ability. And so they say in verse 10, the Chaldeans answered the king and said, there is not a man on earth who could declare the matter for the king. Inasmuch as no great king or ruler has ever asked anything like any magician, conjurer, or Chaldean. I mean, you're asking us to do something. This is an unprecedented request. You're asking us to do something that no king has ever asked. And besides, they go on, moreover, the thing which the king demands is difficult. And there is no one else who could declare it to the king except gods, whose dwelling place is not with mortal men and flesh. And they suggest that the king's request was not only difficult, it was impossible for mortal men. And they admit that the only one who can do this is some kind of divine being or beings, that this is beyond the ability of normal human beings. And I'll tell you what, they were right about that. They were absolutely right about that. That's exactly so. Well, of course, the king is enraged by that. And so he decrees that because they won't do this, that all the wise men of Babylon are to be gathered together and they're going to be executed. And it becomes apparent as you read Daniel chapter 2 and verse 12, beginning at verse 12, that Daniel and his friends, because they're on the advisory staff of the king, they've been placed in this role, in this position, that they also are slated for execution. Now, it turns out that Daniel has not heard about this yet. He doesn't know that the king has made this request of his preeminent Chaldean wise men. But when they come around gathering the wise men for the purpose of execution, Daniel says, what's going on here? And when he learns about the king's decree, he makes a request for the king, from the king to have permission for time to provide what the king has requested. If you'll give me and my friends some time, we can maybe give you what you have asked. That permission is granted. And so this young man with his three friends gather together to pray and to ask God for compassion. They pray, according to verse 18, to request God for compassion from the God of heaven concerning this mystery. Had Daniel ever interpreted dreams before this? I mean, I know that in chapter 1, we're told that Daniel is ultimately also going to be able to understand all kinds of visions and dreams. But these events happen right about the same time as these things, this test is going on. This is very early yet. Has Daniel had opportunity before this to interpret things? Has he ever heard a message from God before? Maybe this is his debut. I don't know. All I do know is that whether or not Daniel had ever had an interpretation or ever been given any revelation from God before this or not, all we know is that Daniel knew that his God could do this. He knew he couldn't do this, but he knew his God could do this. And he trusted his God. And together with his friends, they got together and prayed to God for compassion. I wonder how many gifts of God's compassion we miss out on today because we fail to ask, or because we fail to ask with the same kind of faith. Now, I recognize that God has said there's some things He won't do anymore. I understand that. We can't ask God to do something that's contrary to His will. But I believe that we don't have the kind, very, very often we as the people of God, we do not exemplify the kind of faith that this young man and his three friends had in the God of heaven. Because they're confident that their God can do this thing. And they go and ask. And how many things might we have from the God of heaven if we would simply ask and ask in the same kind of faith that these men have? There's a passage in James chapter 5 where we're taught about praying and about the prayer of righteous men being effective. And the illustration is given of Elijah, who was a man of like nature as we. He wasn't a special guy. He wasn't some guy with some superhuman powers. Elijah was a normal, common guy like you and me. God answered his prayers. And of course, God will not answer prayers in some miraculous way if it's contrary to his will. I'm not saying that. But folks, that text is teaching us that God can answer prayers. Amen. And I'm afraid that sometimes we don't believe that. And because we don't believe it, or because we don't trust in God completely, we're a little bit hesitant. We miss out on some things. Daniel knew what his God could do. He knew he didn't have the power, but he knew what his God could do. And he went to his God and requested compassion that they might be revealed this mystery. And God reveals the mystery to Daniel in verse 19. God showed him in the night vision what Nebuchadnezzar had dreamed and what that dream meant. And so when Daniel wakes up, he with his friends again bless the Lord, give thanks to God for His goodness and for helping them to have the interpretation, for revealing this mystery to them, from saving their lives in this very difficult situation. And he then goes and requests a hearing before the king that he might tell the king his dream and interpret it. Well, he asks for this royal audience in verse 24. And in verse 25, Arioch, king's servant, hurriedly brought Daniel into the king's presence. And the king says to Daniel, "Are you able to make known to me the dream," verse 26, "which I have seen and its interpretation?" And Daniel says, "Nope. I'm not able to. But the God I serve, He's able to." Daniel answered before the king, "As for the mystery about which the king has inquired, neither wise men, conjurers, magicians, nor diviners are able to declare it to the king. However, there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries, and He has made known to the king Nebuchadnezzar what will take place in the latter days. This was your dream and the vision in your mind while you were on your bed." And so he's going to now tell this king, first of all, what he dreamed, and then what the dream means. Verse 31, "You, O king, were looking, and behold, there was a single great statue. That statue, which was large and of extraordinary splendor, was standing in front of you, and its appearance was awesome. And the head of that statue was made of fine gold, and its breasts and its arms of silver, and its belly and its thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly iron and partly clay. You continued looking until a stone was cut out without hands, and it struck the statue on the feet of the iron and the clay and crushed them. And when the iron and the clay... And then the iron, the clay, and the bronze, and the silver, and the gold were crushed all at the same time and became like chaff from the summer threshing floors. And the wind carried them away so that that not a trace of them was found. But the stone that struck the statue became a giant mountain and filled the whole earth." This revelation had to be absolutely shocking to this king. Here is a teenager, essentially, revealing his dreams. Surely now what he tells me the dream means has got to be accurate. And so Daniel does that. This was the dream. Now we will tell its interpretation, O king, before the king. You, O king, are the king of kings, to whom the God of heaven has given the kingdom, the power, the strength, the glory. And wherever the sons of men dwell, or the beasts of the field, or the birds of the sky, he has given them into your hand and has caused you, he has caused you to rule over all them. You are the head of gold. After you, there will arise another kingdom inferior to you, then another third kingdom of bronze, which will rule over all the earth. Then there will be a fourth kingdom as strong as iron. Inasmuch as iron crushes and shatters all things, so like iron that breaks in pieces, it will crush and break all these in pieces. And in that you saw that the feet and toes were partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, it will be a divided kingdom. But it will have in it the toughness of iron, inasmuch as you saw the iron mixed with the common clay. As to the toes and the feet were partly iron and partly clay, so some of the kingdom will be strong and part of it will be brittle. And in that you saw the iron mixed with common clay, they will combine in one another in the seed of men, but they will not adhere to one another, even as iron does not combine with pottery. In the days of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which will never be destroyed. And that kingdom will not be left for another people. It will crush and put an end to all these kingdoms, and it will itself endure forever. Inasmuch as you saw that the stone was cut out of the mountains without hands, and that it crushed the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold, the great God has made known to the king what will take place in the future. So the dream is true, and his interpretation is trustworthy. And you and I, then, stand in a particular point in history which enables us to look back and see that not only was Daniel right about the dream, his interpretation was correct. Because he interprets that this statue that the king saw in his dream, that it represented four kingdoms. The head of gold, one kingdom. The body and chest, the arms and breast of silver. The belly and thigh of bronze. And the iron legs and iron and clay feet of that statue. And sure enough, he gives us the starting point. He says that you, O king Nebuchadnezzar, you and the Babylonian kingdom are the head of gold. And of course, the Babylonians reigned from about 606 B.C. to 539 B.C. They were then replaced by a second kingdom, the Medo-Persian kingdom, from 549 to 331 B.C. And then about 331 B.C., along comes Alexander the Great with his Greeks, and they reign from about 331 to 63 B.C., and finally from about 63 B.C. to A.D. 500 or so, the Roman kingdom ruled. And Daniel said that according to this dream, in the days of those kings, that fourth set of kings, the God of heaven is going to establish a kingdom which will never fail. And sure enough, when we open our New Testaments, during the days of those fourth set of kings, the Roman kings, Jesus comes on the scene in Mark, the first chapter. And what is his message? His message is, the time is fulfilled. After John had been taken into custody, Jesus came into Galilee, verse 14, preaching the gospel of God and saying, the time is fulfilled. The kingdom of God is at hand. Repent and believe in the gospel. And that kingdom was established. Jesus, after his resurrection, was exalted to the right hand of the throne of God, as Peter preached in Acts, the second chapter. And he, the king, now poured forth what they saw and heard. He was now Lord of lords and King of kings. He was on the throne of David, having received the promise of his father, David. And that kingdom has been established. And that's the kingdom that you and I are a part of today. Because according to that prophecy, according to that dream, that kingdom would never end. We're in that kingdom right now. We're enjoying the benefits of that kingdom. We're a part of this kingdom. Nebuchadnezzar, when he heard the interpretation of this dream, he immediately did homage to Daniel. But of course, based on Daniel's earlier actions, we kind of doubt that Daniel accepted that. But Nebuchadnezzar also exalts Daniel's God in verse 47. The king answered Daniel and said, "Surely your God is a God of gods, and a Lord of kings, and a revealer of mysteries, since you have been able to reveal this mystery." Now this may at first appear to be a conversion to the true God on the part of Nebuchadnezzar, but as we will continue in the book of Daniel, we will learn it obviously was not. Though he was genuinely impressed with the God of Daniel, this king evidently knew all the right things to say, but he doesn't truly convert. And I would suggest to you that Nebuchadnezzar acts very much like a number of people today, who when confronted with the God of the Bible, when confronted with the Messiah, with his Messiah, with the Christ who paid the debt for our sins, that there are many people who are impressed with that message and will say the right things, but who do not really convert. They do not commit themselves in the service of that God and that King. But if you're willing to commit yourself in the service of that God and that King, you can enjoy the benefits of being a part of that kingdom that Daniel said would come about, that we are indeed a part of and enjoying today. We'll see that Daniel and his friends are also promoted in Babylon, and we'll pick up tomorrow night with another part of the story. But I want you to recognize that we have some young men who have, in terms of their commitment to God, it is a settled issue. They have decided to serve Him. And because they have put their confidence and trust in Him, even though they are in difficult circumstances, God delivers them. And through their God, they are able to do. Their God is able to do things for them that it would otherwise be impossible. And they let us know about this kingdom that we can be a part of. If you're willing to commit yourself to that God tonight, we'd encourage you to do that. Would you think about that? And if we can help you in some way, would you let us help you while we stand and sing?